The views and opinions expressed by the guests, callers, and hosts on this and all Rents Radio Network programs do not necessarily reflect or agree with those of the network, its commercial sponsors, its radio station affiliates, or internet broadcast platforms. In these controversial times, we believe the First Amendment and freedom of the press are absolutely essential to the survival of our nation. Thank you. And now, enjoy the program.
Okay, and welcome back. It's Friday night, end of another week, beginning of a weekend, which I hope will be good for most all of you. In fact, I hope it'll be good for all of you, but I want to be realistic in my hopes. Some of us will not have a very good weekend, but most of us will have another chance next weekend. How's that for philosophy? Harry Cooper is with us tonight, these first 2 hours. Harry is truly one of the great historians of my lifetime and our times, because he has done more to assemble the facts and the reality of various very, very crucially important parts of World War II. It is often said the winners write the story, and boy, do they. In this case, the winners, the Zionist, International Zionist Bankster Cartel, wrote the story of World War I and certainly orchestrated the hideous, inhuman Treaty of Versailles, which guaranteed World War II. They also wrote the history of World War II. We have spent many, many hours on this program trying to make it very clear that the history of World War II, as we are being taught it, and it's getting worse all the time, bears very scant resemblance to the truth of what really happened in that war. If people were asked, you go and do a man on the street. We used to call them MOS, man on the street interviews. If people were asked, who is the most evil human being that has ever walked the planet? Probably the majority with ease, and maybe even the vast majority, would say without question, Adolf Hitler. And if you were to ask them why, they would say the Holocaust. And that would be the length, breadth, width, and depth of their intelligence and their knowledge, because they have been brainwashed their entire lives. Adolf Hitler was a human being, just like me, just like you, just like anybody else. Geopolitics and the world as it was thrust him into a position of prominence that gave him the chance to literally change the face of modern Western civilization as we know it, in ways that few could even imagine. They ran out of time. The German nation, the German people, those here in the United States, which, by the way, the majority of Americans wanted nothing to do with war in Europe, those in England who wanted nothing to do with the war in Europe, and many around the world, the majority around the world, could see Soviet, Zionist, Jewish, Marxist, communist, socialist Bolshevism running the Soviet Union and destroying the lives of tens upon tens upon tens of millions of human beings, perhaps 100 million people. We don't know for sure. We do know, however, that the winners write the story. And the story of World War II bears virtually no resemblance in terms of Adolf Hitler and what we know about him, to Adolf Hitler, the man. And so what I thought we'd do, to do something different, would be to take a couple of hours and have Harry Cooper and our special guest, David Dees, who does this absolutely brilliant art. He put up the piece together, which I have posted, which shows Adolf Hitler as a human being, not as a two-horned monster. This is an extraordinary picture, and it does give you an idea of how you have been lied to. Now, I'm not here to tell you or to try to sell you on the idea that Adolf Hitler was a saint, an angel, a savior of the planet, or anything. I'm just trying to tell you that you know nothing about Adolf Hitler, the man. Nothing. You actually know nothing about Winston Churchill either. And very little about many of the other characters who supposedly led the West to its great victory over the evil National Socialists in Germany. It's a very, very sad story of massive brainwashing that has gone on for 60 years plus, and it's not going to change. They're teaching Holocaust history now in primary schools around the United States and in Europe, and it's only going to continue to get worse. No one defends the Holocaust, whatever it really was. No one defends picking up hundreds of thousands of people, maybe a couple of million, putting them in work camps, otherwise displacing them, taking their possessions. That's not okay. That doesn't work for me. But to lie about something and then capitalize on it and make trillions of dollars on it ultimately doesn't work for me either. Now, somewhere in between there is the truth, and it's up to you to try to figure that out. Harry, are you there?
Yes, sir, I'm here.
Did you hear any of that?
Yeah, I heard your whole intro.
Did it make any sense?
I'm listening.
Okay.
I'm listening.
You are always listening and learning and teaching. That's the important part. You've seen the picture we put up on the homepage that David Dees put together?
No, I don't have my computers on at this.
Okay, it's a nice collage of Mr. H showing him in rather human behaviors because he was a human being. In fact, tell our listeners, you had something to say. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say any art that comes from David Dees is worth looking at.
It certainly is. What we have here is a story to tell tonight, and it's a story of omission. It's one of the biggest lies in history, the lie of omission, the lies about Hitler, the man, the human being, which, again, most in the West know virtually nothing about. It must, in the work you do with your brilliant Shark Hunters organization and all the wonderful magazines you put out and the books, of which David Dees has done the covers for recently, he's still working on them, just extraordinary art and more extraordinary history in those covers. You must be as frustrated as anyone can be about the manicuring and manipulation of the media and the message and the portrait of the man that we know so little about.
Yeah, it's a little frustrating when when people ask what do? I tell them I'm a historian and one of the probably the world's leading expert on the German U-boats and on Hitler's escape to Argentina. And, of course, right away they think I'm a lunatic. Everybody knows Hitler committed suicide in the bunker because that's what they were taught. And right away just not so much anymore, but in the earlier days they'd ask me if I was a Nazi. And so I'd throw
they
it back.
They actually would ask you to your face.
Are you a Nazi? And so I'd throw it back at him, and I'd ask him, well, describe what is a Nazi. And
well,
they're kind of lost for
that,
a minute.
That ended the conversation.
Well, yeah, then they him and they haw, and I said, well, they finally come up, and, well, you got to be a German. I tell them, well, that leaves me out. I'm an Irishman. So, and then they say, well, you got to love Hitler. And I tell them, I've never met a man I love. I love lots of women, but never loved any men. So then they're really out the door. And
you have been through this a few times, haven't you?
Yeah. They don't think.
They're not taught to think.
That's right. They're not programmed to think. They're programmed to just believe what they're told and to ridicule anybody who has an idea opposite of theirs. You're thought to be just a lunatic because everybody knows. Well, of course, everybody knows a fat guy in a red suit comes down your chimney on Christmas Eve with a bag full of toys, too.
He doesn't?
I'm always asleep by about 9 o'clock, so
okay.
I wouldn't know.
Well, thank you. I don't want that ruined. That's my last fantasy.
Okay. I won't talk about the Easter Bunny then either.
We'll let that slide. Now, what we have to do here is to try. What we're going to try and do is peel back the cover, hiding the reality of Adolf Hitler, and at least take a look at the guy. And sometimes a picture's worth a thousand words. Maybe for you it'll be worth one word or 10 words or 100 words. But I've asked David if we could use, he put a whole bunch of pictures together that we are not allowed to see. The Western media is not allowed to see Adolf Hitler looking human or doing human things. You just won't find any. Now, if you do a search for Adolf Hitler and do hit images, just click on images, look at the pictures. They're photoshopped subtly. Some are photoshopped rather graphically and grotesquely to make the man look like evil incarnate. Go look, do a search for that, enter images, and then look at the pictures we're going to show you tonight. Now, what we're going to show you tonight are not all publicity stunt photos. They're just casual, candid photos in many cases. So sure, some of them are posed pictures. But this is real emotion you're going to see in these pictures. These are real people. And there's a story that has never been told. It's really the greatest story that was never told. And it's the true story of Germany and World War II. We're supposed to have links under the page, top picture. With that, let me welcome our artist, David Dees, who did that little montage, the collage up on top, and real pictures of real people. David, hello and welcome back.
Hi, Jeff. I'm hemming and hawing here, ready to jump into this conversation. And I'm no expert on Adolf Hitler, but I certainly have, since I woke up about 8 years ago to World War I and World War II, what really happened, I have gone through as much, many books and as many documentaries as it takes to get a pretty good understanding of that we were severely lied to. And, I met a nice German girl. She was talking about how they teach the Holocaust to them from grade one. So, you know, how do you even combat such a programming that starts very early in the school system? Anyway, let's talk about that tonight.
Yeah, yeah. Now, what got you, we did talk about this a little bit earlier, what got you kind of tipped in the direction I've been for a long time to just try to ask people to consider the fact that they may have been lied to just a little bit as they were growing up, and that there's a whole other side of this World War II story that they don't know about. And it really starts at the top. It starts at the top with the man that is the most evil human being ever to walk this earth. And you ask people, and they'll tell you that. I've seen polls done, and I think I've seen one or two man-on-the-street things done over the years asking that very question, and it comes back invariably, Adolf Hitler.
Sure. Type in the most evil men on the planet, and he'll certainly be in the top five. But to understand anything about Hitler in World War II, you have to understand World War I, and that Germany was the victim in that. Most people don't even know that. You never hear much about World War I, but World War II was just simply they went back to do their job, and that was the bankers wanted to destroy Germany. Germany was winning the Industrial Revolution. They're so, amazing with technology that the vast, expansive railroad system throughout Europe and had great factories producing their products, and they were just happily going along their way. And the bankers just said, okay, we have to shut this down because we can't have this competition. So when they declared war on Germany in 1914, Germany, you know, nobody even invaded Germany. They declared war, but Germany just set out and just stopped everything. And within 2 years, they had won the war. And if you know about that, the Zionists went and they went to England and said, you're going to lose this war, but we will bring America in if you give us Palestine.
Right.
This is a very complicated, long subject. I don't know how much time we have for me to even try to explain this, but what we have is Hitler came to power after Germany was basically destroyed in World War I. He came into power in 1933, and the Zionists knew that he was going to clean house. He knew all about what they had done to Russia, the Bolsheviks they took over and killed the royal family there. With the bankers that put the money and brought all these Jews in to lead this revolution. It wasn't a revolution at all because most of these weren't even Russians. So, the Red Terror, they call it, you know, they started to kill and destroy most of Russian society, the millions that they killed, and Hitler was well aware of this. He wrote it in Mein Kampf. He wrote it. He knew what the Zionists were doing, that they, when they go into a country, they take over the three power centers. They take over the media, the politics, and the banking. And that's what they had done to Germany. So when he came into power, he just said, okay, we're going to clean house. And that's when, if you type in, Judea declares war on Germany, the Jews declared war on Germany in 1933. It was on the cover of the newspapers. So this is what he, as soon as he came into power,
right.
What he was faced with was that the Jews were already declaring war on Germany. And
said, they did it in 1933. It's a world Jewry declares war on Germany. I mean, it was right there.
They boycotted any German products, and if you had German products in your store, you know, the windows would be broken, or they would just come in and just wreck your place. So people were afraid to even put any product in their store that said "Made in Germany" on it at that point. And
now Harry Cooper is standing by. Harry has done. What was it, 10 programs today, Harry? You did?
Right. Well, no, this is my third two-hour program today. Jeez. We started at 10 o'clock in the morning. Of course, I've been in my office since about 2:30 this morning. You guys get my emails. And then I was on the air from 10 until noon, and then again from 3 until 5. And in between there, I'm putting more pages together in my magazine. I've got one more page to do, and it's going to get published over the weekend. Jeff, you get it.
And, wonderful magazine.
Yeah, thank you. Incidentally, if any of your listeners want a free copy, all they have to do is send me an email at sharkhunters@earthlink.net and say they heard this show and they want a free copy of the magazine by email, and I'll send it right out to them. No cost, no strings attached.
That's very nice. Shark Hunters is an organization unique in the world because Harry Cooper has made it a point to honor soldiers who fought under all flags. It's not simply all about Germany. It's about American soldiers. It's even about Soviet soldiers. He is respected in Russia. He's respected all over the place because he recognizes that all of these men were fighting for their countries. And when you talk about Germany, everyone says Nazi.
Harry, that sells paper.
Of course. Explain what the term Nazi really means, and then we'll talk more about the party itself.
Well, to my knowledge, to my understanding, that was a term coined by the British propagandists because the Germans knew themselves as Socis because they were the NSDAP, the National Socialist Deutsches Arbeiterpartei, the National Socialist German Workers' Party. So they were Socis. But I have said for years that if you put a swastika and a picture of Adolf Hitler on the Manhattan phone book, you could probably sell a million copies just because of the imagery.
It's true. I used to walk by paperback book stands, and I know David used to do the same thing. If you just scan it, this was in the 80s and so forth, you'll see swastikas all over the faces of books. I mean, every 10 or 15 books, it seemed like there in fiction there would be a swastika. Because it sells. You're right.
It sells, yeah. And let me touch on a point you made earlier, that we're not allowed to anything about Hitler in a positive light. That's true. And in Germany, it's a crime. If you publish anything about Hitler or the party, it has to paint them in a negative light. If you try to show nice pictures of them in Germany, it's a crime. Because they say that you're aggrandizing them or whatever, and that's a crime over there. And for some time it was a crime to deny the Holocaust, and people like David Duke, who's a friend of mine, and David Irving, etc., they are branded as Holocaust deniers, and that's a crime in Germany and now in most of Europe. And now they've passed another law. It's against the law to even question the Holocaust over there.
Imagine something of that historically enormous significance not being able to be investigated, analyzed, or researched. It is,
yeah.
It's a crime to do it. Seriously.
Yeah, I mean, strange laws. If you raise your right arm in the so-called Nazi salute, you're going to get fined over there. You're at least going to get fined, 2,500 euros, which is about 3,200 Yankee dollars. But the dumbest thing, it's not even the Nazi salute, as it's called. It's the Roman salute. When Romans would greet each other, they would raise their right arm, hand outstretched, to show they have no weapon.
Julius Caesar.
Oh, yeah. My number one hero in the whole world, Julius Caesar. And I stuck it out through the first couple of years of boring Latin class to where we could finally get to our... We read Caesar's commentaries on the Gallic War.
Oh, fascinating. Yeah.
Oh, man, I love that that history.
That's a remarkable book. Okay. Hold on just a minute. We'll come right back with Harry and I and our special guest, David Dees, whose artwork is up at the top of Rents.com. And I'm going to play some clips for you that were spoken by the man who was Hitler's personal assistant for a period of 6 years, who was literally his shadow, and knew an awful lot about him. Interviewed shortly before he died, I think a couple of years ago, and we'll hear some of that and some other things as well. Stay tuned. Okay, and we're back. Now, where do we go next here? This is it's such a big story. We're going to try and make it work in the next 90 minutes.
I have a suggestion.
Oh, you do you?
I do.
Go ahead.
Well, I would say that, Adolf Hitler, he wanted to be a professional artist, and he took his paintings, his architectural renderings, to Vienna early on in his teens and 20s. I don't know exactly his age, but he was rejected twice.
It was right after World War One, basically.
I thought it was before World War One.
Well, he was painting all the way through. He painted into the 30s, actually. So,
yeah, see, he was rejected before World War One. He was rejected from the Vienna School, and then
twice.
He was, twice. And then he floundered around, and then when World War One started, he went in. He volunteered and went in, and he did paintings for the other soldiers.
Right.
When he was there, and. But he was a very decorated war hero. He had 6 medals, and he was shot a couple of times, and while other people probably would try to, get away for all this fighting and stuff, he requested to be taken back to the front, and he kept going back into the war, and his position was as a runner. He would run from, up to the front line and take
messages back and forth.
Yeah.
What's amazing about the descriptions that are reported about him is that he never once expressed the least bit of fear about anything. It was a very strange personality. No
right,
worry about his safety.
That,
yeah.
Right. A lot of those people that were doing that were getting killed, and he requested to go back into that position after he had been wounded. And so he got the respect of all the other soldiers. He brought people together very well, but he was not ever a politician. No one. In fact, he was a corporal, and he was not promoted because, as the sergeant made a note, was that he didn't have leadership qualities. So, he was certainly not a politician. Was not a leader at that point. And it was only after after World War One, when the Treaty of Versailles, when Germany basically got raped and destroyed from the Zionists, they took, a huge percentage of land. They created Czechoslovakia. That was a new country. 3 million Germans were now in a different country. They took away land from Germany. And also in Poland, there was another huge piece of land that divided, the Germans away from their homeland. So, and in a part of France. So, his whole thrust into politics or as a leader came because of what horrible things they had done to Germany. I mean, they really had, the design was to destroy Germany, destroy the people, destroy their ability to participate in world, the Industrial Revolution. That's really what this was all about. You know, they'll tell you all these other crazy ideas of why World War One and World War Two started, but that's not the truth. The truth was is that they just didn't like the Germans taking over, taking over the world in a sense. I mean, they were very talented. That's if you were accused of anything of Germany, they were so talented they had to be stopped. That's what it was all about. So.
Harry, anything you want to add to that description? I mean, the Treaty of Versailles was, without question, the cruelest, stupidest, in the sense that it guaranteed another world war, but maybe that was the plan, treaty that I've ever seen.
Yeah, I don't know if that was the plan or not, but it certainly did bring that to the front, because Germany was just so devastated financially, politically, et cetera. And when Hitler was running for office, I think they had something like 60-something different political parties. And he was able to pull them together, and you saw the rallies, hundreds of thousands of people. And that's what brought in a lot of the operating capital, because people had to pay to be at those rallies. And also, everybody had to have their copy of Mein Kampf, which ultimately was the second biggest selling book ever in history. But something David mentioned there about Germany being partitioned off after World War One, that's absolutely correct. And that's what helped, that's what, in my opinion, actually did cause the outbreak of World War Two. We're taught that Adolf Hitler started World War II because he hated the Jews and he wanted to be king of the world, or ruler, whatever title you want to give it. And it's just absolutely ludicrous. As far as hating the Jews, I had a friend, he's now passed away. He was a U-boat skipper, Helmut Schmuckel. He was half Jewish. So why was he driving a U-boat if he was Jewish?
Anywhere from 200,000 to 500,000 Jews served in the German military in the war.
Absolutely correct. What caused the problem was in Poland. Poland didn't exist from the medieval days up until 1918. Poland didn't exist. And then the victorious Allies took out a pencil and ran some lines around on a map and said, okay, now this is Poland. It used to be East Prussia and Pomerania, et cetera, and there were tons of Germans that suddenly lived in a foreign country, even though they never moved. They were in the same home, the same business, but now they were in Poland. And the last 2 weeks in August 1939, some 450,000 ethnic Germans, Volksdeutscher, were forcibly shoved out of their homes that they had been in for generations, their businesses, their farms, their homes. They were just kicked out, and 49,000 were massacred by the German, by the Polish.
The Poles.
Officials and civilians.
Most of them were the Bolsheviks who had infiltrated Poland and most of Europe, trying to take it over on behalf of the Soviets.
Well, whatever the reason was, that's what happened. And Jeff, you've seen pictures. I've sent you a few of the pictures of the Volksdeutschers, the bodies, their hands tied. And so that's why Hitler had to send the people in, and Churchill knew it was coming, and that's why he warned Germany that if you come in, Britain and France are going to declare war against you guys.
There's so much to this. Well, when we come back after the break, we're going to tell you how Hitler saved Europe for almost 5 years, anyway, from the Soviet hordes. And some of you are saying, what? Hang on, and we'll tell you. Be right back with Harry and David Dees in just a minute. Once again, we know so little about Germany and the German people. All we know of is the Nazi party and the Nazis and all that. The Germans came up with extraordinary firsts in science, in culture, in finance, all kinds of things.
Weaponry.
What's that?
Weaponry. Weaponry.
Oh, well, my God, the science and technology of their weapon systems were... 6 more months and the world would be a much different place than it is now. The war on cancer. Hitler was the first man, the first government, the German government, to declare war on cancer. They declared war on smoking. Hitler personally was a vegan vegetarian and promoted the vegetarian lifestyle. They promoted physical fitness. These people were so far advanced in so many ways that there were other countries nearby that were, shall we say, just a little jealous of the progress that Germans made in the arts, the sciences, and especially in industry and technology, not to mention literature and music and all the rest of it. It was a giant, and it had to be taken down because it was walking away from Great Britain, so-called Great Britain. France, vive la France, and the great French resistance that didn't really exist outside of a handful of people. And don't write me emails, look at the history books, the real ones. Now, Harry, how did Adolf Hitler, or Adolf Hitler, however you wish to pronounce it, save Europe's ass for the better part of 5 years?
I'll defer to you and David on this one because you guys know.
Well, Barbarossa, everyone knows Barbarossa.
Yeah.
And all right, let me just do this real simply. Then you guys add what you can. Hitler had a very good intelligence agency, excellent, called the what, Harry? The Abwehr.
The Abwehr, which means defense.
All right.
They also had the Sicherheitsdienst of the SS, which. Sicherheitsdienst is the security service.
All right. Well, Hitler and his general staff found out that Joseph Stalin had moved approximately, my sources, 4 to 6 million men up stealthily in secret to the boundaries of Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union. Heavy weapons, artillery, you name it.
Yeah, he had a couple of field armies moved over there, yeah.
And the plan was that they were just about to launch a massive campaign to conquer Europe, to roll all the way to the English Channel and slaughter everything in the way. The German government found out about this, and in unbelievably short amounts of time was able to assemble 3 major armies and attack the Soviets before they could launch their war to smash, destroy, and conquer Europe. Now, Hitler moved, I think it's generally considered, about 2 weeks before the attack was to begin by the Soviet hordes.
Yeah, that's pretty well accepted.
And he actually, his tacticians, and Hitler from World War I, he understood a lot. The bottom line is that the German military encircled this entire massive conglomeration of men and equipment, horses, you name it, supply lines, and cut them off from the Soviet Union and prevented them from destroying Europe. This would have been a nightmare, no question about it. David, what have you read about Operation Barbarossa and the foresight of the German government to launch this war against the Soviet Union? No one ever talks about how the fact that the Soviets were about to launch a war on Europe.
Yeah, they had already done it to all their satellite states, Estonia, Ukraine, and Ukraine was still wanting its independence. And if you know it, in 1930, I don't know my dates, was it 34? The Red Army surrounded Ukraine and took all of their grain and forced them into a starvation period of 2 years, and these poor people in Ukraine were starved for 2 years, and they estimate 2 million people died.
Oh, two, so easy, Hitler, more.
Yeah,
but anyway,
Hitler was well aware of all the horror that the Red Army brought, and Europe was too. And here they were poised, and they'd already taken over all their satellite countries. And we're getting ready to roll right into Europe, and they could have. Hitler, the Operation Barbarossa, found all these troops, these Soviet troops, right on the border, ready to come in. They beat them by 2 weeks because 2 weeks they had planned to invade Europe. So this was 1941.
And the way that the Germans did it was brilliant. They moved south and they moved north, and moved quickly. The Soviets were all faced and positioned west in the direction of their attack, and the Germans were able to encircle them and just cut them to pieces, basically. I think they captured 1 or 2 million of them as POWs.
Right. They talk about how Hitler was photographed at the Eiffel Tower, that, you know, the Germans had rolled into France, and it was like, it's such a horrible thing. Well, guess what? The photographs of France during the German occupation was business as usual. All the shops were open, all the people were out still, and they really liked the Germans because they knew that they were protected from the Russians, from the Soviets. That's who they were really afraid of.
That's a very good point. Harry, what were you going to say?
Well, a couple of things. First off, the Soviets were caught a little off guard by Barbarossa, because one of the main things that Stalin had his spook looking for was the German military going to be buying huge amounts of sheep wool to line jackets with for a war invading the Soviet Union. They figured that they would have to have warm clothing for the troops if they were going to invade the Soviet Union. And Germany mobilized so quickly to head east that they didn't have time to even get any of this wool. And so the fact that they weren't buying making the warm clothing for the soldiers, Stalin didn't realize they were coming.
Joseph Stalin, our great ally, Uncle Joe.
Yeah,
what a wonderful monster.
I was a kid during the war years, and I remember how we all loved Uncle Joe. We were told he wasn't even a Russian, for God's sake.
Nope. Here's another thing about the National Socialist Party in Germany. And I've got this up. You can listen to it. Look underneath David's splash art at the top. A little montage of Hitler and human poses, which you will not see because those pictures are not allowed to be published over here in the West, as it were, by certain interests. There was an interview done with the man called often Hitler's shadow, his personal assistant, his manservant, if you will, his coordinator of affairs and events, his clothing to dinners and you name it. This man led an extraordinary life for 6 years, serving, Hitler, but working with him. Hitler confided many things, to him. I'm going to play a small clip of what Hitler said and how he really felt about the National Socialist Party. This is quite extraordinary. I hope it plays. Let's see.
It was exactly like this with me. I wasn't a party member. Everyone, especially the top people, had been telling me that I should join the party. And I thought to myself, well, what should I do? Finally, I said, my Führer, everyone wants me to join the party. What should I do? He looked at me and said, no, you don't need to join the party. You're a soldier. Serve me as a soldier. And then he said, you know, I may just dissolve the party altogether. Yes, that's what he said. Sorry if I digress here, but Herr Wagner once said, Adolf, and I should add that he and Hitler were on a first-name basis with one another whenever they were together. But of course, just not in public. And it was exactly the same way with us. We simply called him the boss. It was never, the Führer is doing this or doing that. But of course, when there were strangers or prominent people around, yes, then of course we would refer to him as the Führer. But otherwise, he was just the boss. With the organizers, it was the same thing. That was just normal. It wasn't always the Führer or Herr Hitler or whatever. For us, he was just the boss. But back to the topic. Hitler said then, there are only Germans and no party. He really said that. It was in the city of Bayreuth when we were with Winfried Wagner, and I was perhaps just 2 or 3 meters away when he said it.
Pretty extraordinary stuff, which you never hear. And I'm glad to be able to bring that little tidbit to you, and there'll be a couple more. Carl Wilhelm Krauss, Hitler's personal assistant, relaying some of the things that he overheard with Hitler. Now, I also would like to invite you to look in the guests section at rents.com, and you'll find a whole bunch of photographs, which we're going to look at in the second hour, of, well, they're photographs of Hitler that you'll not see. No pun intended. That just kind of snuck out there. You will find them rarely, if anywhere, and I put them up also on the right-hand side of my homepage. There's a special column on real history. I want to repeat this just for the record. I'm not here, neither is David, nor is Harry, to promote anything that would be considered outrageous or outlandish. We're just trying to present the truth here, that Adolf Hitler was a man, a human being, and you just heard his personal assistant say that everything was about the German people. He never wanted Germany to suffer the humiliation, the degradation, and the near catastrophic permanent loss of its own identity, which it came face to face with in the 20s when the Bolsheviks were trying to take it over. Again, that's the big story. There's a lot to learn, and that's why real history is fascinating, and also why it's so difficult to come across and find. Okay, look in guests, the hidden Adolf Hitler photos. We'll be looking at some of those. And then take a look at some of the paintings that this very young man did. How old was he, David, when he painted? Teens and older?
Yeah, his whole life he was an artist, and really good stuff. I mean, if you know anything, if you've ever tried to draw
watercolors?
Very complex buildings, yeah, his buildings are really well done.
He's not only the buildings, but he also did very accomplished. The Madonna and Child and religious paintings as well.
Right, nobody knows that either. Okay, hold on, friends, we'll come right back in just a couple. Okay, let's get right to our number two. Todd, no breaks this hour at all. We're going to go all the way through without interruption. This is a special program, the likes of which probably has never been done on radio at this level. I would draw your attention to the top splash art at Rents, done by David Dees. Really a very, very nice montage, which is very revealing if you look at it carefully. Underneath are two links. One is to a documentary called The Greatest Story Never Told. If you never watch another documentary about history or the world we live in, you must look at this one. It will tell you, black and white, why we are in the fix we are in. You'll see it there. The second one is Hitler's personal assistant, remembers the boss. And I'm going to play a little segment of that right now for you. Carl Wilhelm Krauss, regarding his personal interaction with Adolf Hitler, what he was like, his interactions with him, his peculiarities, his character, his goals and desires, and anecdotes from what he observed firsthand, personally. So take a listen. This is real history, real truth.
He was undemanding. It was really only when foreigners, ladies, or dignitaries were present that he expected that the proper etiquette be maintained. But otherwise, he was easy to please. What were his personal expectations? None. What he did, or what he had built, he did for his people, not for himself. He was an uncomplicated man, that's clear. When others, or how shall I say it, important personalities were present, then he would become almost fearful, not regarding himself, but rather that things could go wrong. It was just his concern that things might not turn out as planned, and he could become worried, almost afraid. His mission was to raise the German people up to the highest level. That was his idea. He wanted things to finally go well for the Germans. In terms of his personal possessions, he had a big iron bed, a closet for clothes.
Just a little buffering here. He didn't live the life of luxury. He didn't live in a palace. And he only stood on ceremony when it was required, when there were international or national dignitaries there. And he kept it very simple. Harry, anything to jump in here real quick while this is
rebooting? Yeah. Now, it's been said, like I say, I'm not the expert on Hitler the man, but it's been said that he liked the mountains of Bavaria far better than Berlin, which was just a big city. And that's why he had his home down there in up on the Ober Salzburg, which just a week or two before the end of the war, the Brits bombed it, and Goering's house and Bormann's house there on the Ober Salzburg. And then the houses were still there, but badly damaged when the U.S. Army took over. And as soon as the U.S. Army gave that area back to the Bavarian government, though, 10 or so years ago, boy, the Bavarian government didn't waste any time sending in the bulldozers. Absolutely nothing left of the homes of Goering, Bormann, and Hitler. There are still some buildings there, but not their homes. Matter of fact, there's a multi-zillion dollar hotel built where Goering's home had been. And on the bare spot where Hitler's home, the Berghof, was, there recently they just put up a sign, 4 years ago, 5 years ago, something like that. They put up a sign saying this was Hitler's retreat home or whatever, vacation home. And it was here that the slaughter of 6 million people was planned. Every place Hitler even put his foot down, that's where the slaughter of 6 million people was planned. Every place he even put his foot down.
Kept him awake nights, I'm sure, planning, plotting, trying to figure out a way to do it. The little bits of technical problems with killing and disposing of 6 million bodies. Mm-hmm. The Germans kept meticulous records, and it is well known how many crematories were located at each of the labor camps. And had 6 million been exterminated, it would have taken at minimum 75 years to cremate that many bodies, given the amount of crematoria that were there. So just a few problems.
Just a little bit.
Yeah, David.
Also, the forensic evidence of the Holocaust is easy to study. The chemical this poison they say was used was not even found in what they call the gas chamber. That was even the curator of the Holocaust Museum in Auschwitz admitted on camera that this was fabrication by the Russian troops after the war. The chimney that's adjacent to it is not even connected to that building. So you can see where the walls were torn out of the, it was a bomb shelter that was, they converted and said.
Exactly, under orders of Joseph Stalin to keep the world looking at the evil Nazis and not looking while they continued to mop up and slaughter people in East Europe. Anyone who would oppose them, they would just kill. Between 1945, at the end of the cessation of hostilities between that year, April and May of 45 to 1953, about 8 million Germans, 5 to 8 million, were killed off by Bolshevik Zionists, and they were removed to try to remove any vestige of German pride, of German history, of German culture and identity. I mean, it was really quite
Also, during the war, the Americans and the Brits also flew over looking for any. They bombed Germany back to the Stone Age. They dropped 75-100% more bombs on Germany than Germany was able to drop on England. But they also flew over Germany and took these incredible photographs, detailed photographs, looking for targets. And they were well aware of the concentration camps. And all these photographs, there's not a single one that has anything to do with,
They never bombed one rail line to any of the labor
any
camps.
There was no mass graves.
No.
There was nothing that would give you evidence that any bodies were being burned. There was no people lined up. And they have all these photographs, and they never talk about the fact that, you know, there's not one single photograph or any evidence of a Holocaust, of a gas chamber that's being used to destroy
people. Yes, there were dead bodies in the camps, I must say, David, but
yes,
they died of typhus and starvation. Many of the other bodies shown, allegedly, of Jews are actually Germans, immolated in Dresden, for example, piles and piles of bodies. You got to hand it to them. They're very, very clever. They're very clever.
Well, when you own the media, think about what we saw in 9/11. Story, you know. So, you know, when you own the media, you can make movies, you can make documentaries, and you can show them on your channels over and over. The History Channel, what a joke. You know, they call it the Hitler Channel for a while because they just made all these documentaries saying that he was evil, he started the war, on and on. It's not true. He was defending Germany.
Britain bombed Berlin and German cities before the Germans bombed Britain. It's a fact. But we're not
taught
that.
From Standard Oil and what
they call
the Seven Sisters. Standard Oil, Texaco, yeah. Shell, Humble Oil.
That's right.
I forget the rest.
It's all about money. Ford Motors was building the trucks for the German army. People just don't know these things.
So is General Motors, although that's not well known. They have a subsidiary over there, the Adam Opel Company,
mm-hmm.
and they were building tanks and armored cars out of there. And the director of that company, even when in the beginning of the war, before the U.S. was in the war, he was a reserve United States Navy lieutenant commander. And he received a medal from the German government, the Kriegsverdienstkreuz, which is the War Service Cross, for his efforts, for his plant's efforts building tanks and armored cars. So, the General Motors was everybody for God's sake was making money in the war.
That's what it's all about.
Sold to everybody.
Yeah, they didn't care. Here's, let me see if I can play the rest of this comment by Hitler's personal assistant.
So that's the sort of thing where I had to wonder a little bit and ask, you know, what for, really? But he was really a simple man. The simplest man there ever was. Again, when there were important people, ladies, film stars, etc. present, then he insisted upon etiquette. Then nothing dared go wrong. When we got into the car and he would sit down and he would be wearing his long overcoat, I would grab his collar from behind him and I would pull him up and then he could settle himself in. And he would say sometimes along the way, remember this when you write your memoirs, how you would grab me by the collar and pull me up. And with that, I just want to demonstrate how simple he was to deal with. One time he said to me, and this was in the early days, Herr Krause, when are you ever going to go out? And I said,
let's see if we can get it to play. This is the joy of YouTube. I'll keep that.
All this high-tech stuff.
Well, here we go. When the Führer goes to bed. Oh, he said, with a laugh. Well, then I'll have to ring for a very long time. You see, there was this box, and this thing would drop down to notify me when the Fuhrer had rang. Well, he said, just remember then, when you go out, that there are two types of women. And then he stopped and said, oh, wait a minute, you're a Navy man. And he put his finger to his head like this, and he said, you're an experienced sailor, so you would know all the tricks. And with that, again, I just want to demonstrate how easygoing he was with things. He loved children. That's clear. That could never be feigned. Even the historians...
Yeah, what he was going to say there is that the historians, they agree that, you know, if you look at these photographs...
Not that much. It was not feigned. His main concern was he wanted to ensure that nothing would ever befall his people again. He took it upon himself, and he said, never again. Earlier, in the First World War, he was a message carrier. And so he had to run across the front lines, often through a hail of bullets. And you have to realize that, in those situations, one totally loses touch with the feeling of fear. If anyone had wanted to, it would have been easy to assassinate him. But when something was really bothering him, he became quiet.
Okay, just another little glimpse of Hitler the man, which you will never hear about anywhere. Now, if I might, let us go to the guests section at my homepage, and let's look at some pictures. Look underneath Harry Cooper's name and special guest David Dees, and it says the hidden Adolf Hitler photos. Load those
up. It's on
the
left there. It's on the left side there?
Yeah. It's on the left side of the homepage in the guests section. And just hit that link, the hidden Adolf Hitler, and let's take a look at some of these pictures. Now, Harry can't see them, but they're pictures, Harry, by and large, of Hitler with children. And he really did love children.
Right.
This, again, it can't be feigned. There's no question about it. And he truly, from everything I can gather, and you look at the, he loved Germany and its people and respected them and wanted nothing horrible to befall them again as it had happened after World War One. That was his prime motivation, not world conquest. That's BS.
Well, he definitely said, not world conquest.
He didn't want to fight the British, for God's sakes. He'd bent over backwards to stop that war over and over again, even sending Rudolf Hess over, his personal first deputy over there, to try to make peace. He let the British army escape from Dunkirk. They had to leave their weapons behind, but come on, is this a ruthless, bloodthirsty killer? No. It's a man who wants peace. He says, well, let them have their men back. Maybe they'll be happy and stop this crap. He did everything humanly possible to prevent war in the West. He knew the enemy. The enemy was Bolshevism. Zionist, Jewish, Marxist, Communist, Socialist, Bolshevism, okay? That's what the enemy was. It wasn't the British people, it wasn't the French people, it wasn't the Austrian people, the Italian people, none of that. So, David, go ahead. Add something. You go ahead, and then we'll go through these pictures.
I have so many things to say. I would say, you know, there's a book called The Myth of German Villainy. I recommend everybody read it. The author is Bradbury. And it takes you through the Communist Manifesto, World War One, you know, the First Zionist Congress, World War Two. But, you know, it really puts it all together. It's called The Myth of German Villainy. I highly recommend that. Also, this documentary you have, The Greatest Story Never Told. It's 6 hours long, but please at least watch the first hour. It's so well done, and it puts it all together.
It's really excellent. I've watched that too when I was visiting a buddy down in Honduras. I watched a lot of it. It is really excellent.
And what you realize is how adored he was. He was absolutely worshipped, because when he came in, He brought Germany up. They were last place in Europe economically. People had no jobs. They were desperate. They were had just been wrecked by the Zionists in World War One, and he put everybody back to work. He built incredible highway systems, and he gave very motivating speeches. When he would give a talk, people just tears rolling down their face because they wanted to be so much a part of his idea for the future. And even Austria, they saw what was going on, and they said, we want to be a part of Germany, too. And so, when they rolled into Austria, it was 97% voted to be a part of Germany again. So he had a tremendous amount of effect on people. They loved him for it because he made them feel important, that they had a strong family, be healthy.
They were very worthy. To be held in shame. And stepped upon and kicked around and used as the most vile of conveniences by the British and by the elite of Europe.
And between 1933 and before the war started, Germany was the glory years. Everybody was happy. Everybody was working, and the photographs from that era and the films show the happiest people. And boy, you think they wanted a war? They didn't want a war. They wanted to live their lives and just like we all want to. And I really think that the reason that Germany is promoted as evil and all these things is that the Zionists really don't want anybody to get any ideas and start doing what they tried to do.
They don't want happiness, David. Yeah. They want stress. No. They want debt. They want angst. Yeah. Anguish and all the rest of it. They want people held underneath their boot, and they've done a pretty damn good job of it. These pictures tell quite a story. I hope all of you can load them up and take a look. Again, all we're trying to do tonight is to balance history with things that you have never seen before and would never be allowed to see if it weren't for David compiling these, and we were able to have a platform to present them to you. It's just a fact. When you look at the drunk Winston Churchill and his insane, they called him Bomber Harris, they did was bomb the German people. The German civilians were the target. They weren't military targets. The Germans were too smart to have their factories sitting out in the open. They put them underground. They hid them. So what did they do? They dropped city-busting raids on the German people for years. And I don't know how the Germans withstood it as well as they did. Their technology was absolutely mind-boggling what they were doing.
We've been in some of their bomb shelters over there. You know, I bring people over on tours. We've got a tour coming up in September.
Yeah.
And they had bomb shelters way deep underground, and they even had the latrines, but they didn't want to call them latrines, because that was a French word, I guess, so they call them the abort, the Herren abort, mm-hmm. and the Frauen abort, and they had rooms, 90 or 100 feet down below the ground, this huge underground complex, rooms for sleeping, rooms for eating, just to keep the people alive. They got a huge underground bomb shelter in Nuremberg, too, which is now closed, not for any secret reason. It's just that it was worthless. There was nothing positive that the government could use it for nowadays. So they just, they were going to fill it up with sand. We were over there a few years ago, and a friend of mine is the assistant to the mayor, and they said they were going to fill this huge underground bomb shelter with sand. And I thought at the time, how are you going to fill it with sand? Because there's no way you can get it fully compacted in there. You're going to have some kind of a gap under the ceiling. You can't get it filled up and jammed in. So some bright engineer over there came up with the same decision. So all they did was just close it. They locked it up, and that's it. It's not used for anything, but we visit over there, and you can see how the doorways were painted with a luminescent paint to where if the electric went out, you could see where you were going. And, you're right. They were trying to stay alive. They had very strong family values. Who were the Goebbels? Goebbels, the propaganda minister, he had an affair going with this gorgeous movie star named Lidia Barova, who was from Czechoslovakia or one of those countries, and he told Hitler that he wanted to divorce Frau Goebbels and marry Lidia Barova. Hitler told him, absolutely not. That's not the image we want to portray. You cannot divorce your wife and marry her. And Lidia Barova got a midnight visit from the guys in the trench coats and told her, find another hobby. And the next day she left and went back to, I think it was Bohemia. Wherever it was, she went back, and that was the end of that. You know, Hitler didn't...
Well, you're right. These were the values that actually, if you think about it, made America great.
Yeah.
When we had our greatest decade, the 1950s.
Yeah.
Family values were there. Oh, people cheated. They did all kinds of things. But generally speaking, the image was Norman Rockwell, the nuclear family, work, home, happiness, job, family, love, respect.
It was exactly
that way. And it was promoted on TV also, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, the sitcoms were all had a message, and the families were a strong unit.
Well,
right. That's all changed. They want to destroy the family.
Right, of course.
I was a teenager in the 50s, and it's exactly like you see on Happy Days and American Graffiti. My dad worked. My mom stayed home. I walked to school two blocks away. We went to church on Sunday. My dad was the choir director. He was president of the board of trustees for the church. And my sister and I had the little pins for attendance, you know, with all the little add-ons, you know, like about 10 years without missing Sunday school. You didn't swear. And when I was in high school, anybody who even thought about drugs was referred to as a dope fiend. And you know, the biggest drug they were trying to get a hold of was beer. It was really a good time. The keys were always left in the car.
Yeah, yeah.
The
Your
house,
door was unlocked. You didn't have any problems.
Right. And
it's true.
When I was like I say, when I was a teenager, we lived in a little suburb of Chicago. There was only 700 people there when we moved in. Now there's like 50,000. But everybody knew anybody. And if the Widow Johnson came out of the local store and my buddy Billy and I were there, we better carry her groceries home for us or we were going to get our butt whipped. And then when we got to her house, she invited us in for hot cocoa. You can't do that nowadays. And it's really sad how things have changed. Laws too, the simple laws and complex laws. Out here in Hillbilly Heaven where I live, whenever they make a two-lane road into a four-lane road, they drop the speed limit. Yet when I was learning to drive back in the 50s, the speed limit in almost every rural area was reasonable and prudent. It was not 50 or 60 or whatever. It was, however, it was safe to go.
We had common sense, Harry. Come on. You didn't need to post speed limits because people understood how safety was dependent upon them and respecting others. Do unto others the golden rule. People took care of themselves. We don't need every law that is passed in this country takes away a bit more freedom, and there's not much left to take. Here's a little bit more from Hitler's personal assistant. Let me get another 40 seconds out of this.
In some way, come to terms with the issue that was on his mind. He would spend a lot of time reading. Every week, he would read every illustrated magazine that was available in Germany, or at very least, flip through them. I would also buy books for him. Anytime I saw a new book that I thought would be of interest to him, I would buy it and give it to him. And this one time, he really amazed me. It was evening, and there were perhaps 12 or 15 people at the table having dinner. And he started to talk about this new book he had been reading. And he said, I've read this book, and it says that. And I thought to myself, that's impossible. I just gave him that book yesterday. He could not have finished reading that book already. And then he said to me, please go up and get the book for me. It's on my nightstand. So I bring it down, and he says to open it to a certain page number and to read it. And so I opened it and began to read it aloud. And then I thought to myself, he could not have read this book in a single night. It would have taken me a few full days to read it, and he didn't even spend all night with it. I was just dumbfounded. How on earth did he do that? I mean, he had so many other things on his mind to deal with, but he had already memorized many things from this same book. I was just stunned. I was really amazed, too, when we would get on board a plane, how he would notice right away if one of the engines wasn't running exactly the same as the others. And he would say to me, please go ask them about it. Other times, when we were out riding in the car, if a spark plug might be misfiring, he sensed it at once.
All right, just another little glimpse from Hitler's personal assistant. Okay, let's look at the pictures that David has put together for us as we continue. If you just joined us, Harry Cooper is here, his once-a-month meeting with yours truly and all of you wonderful folks, and we're just taking a look at the human side of the most evil man in history. All right, David, these pictures are extraordinary, and if you all can load them up, they're right under, on the left-hand side, under guests. You'll see them, and load them up, and we'll take a look. Okay, if we want to go down, the first picture is of Hitler reaching over to pet the cheek of a very sweet little 2 or 3 year old girl being held up by one of his assistants. The next picture is of Hitler in a group. He's wearing a double-breasted suit in a group of young women, I don't know, teenagers. And look at the look on their faces. Joy. Just joy. This is a remarkable picture, and it shows him smiling. He's very proud of them. You can tell he's not getting off on this. He's just very proud of them. Next picture is of Mr. Hitler feeding wild deer out in the forest somewhere. Next picture
is
of him.
He loved animals so much.
Yeah, he loved animals. Next picture is of him in what we'd call a chaise lounge, laid back, appearing to nap. And sitting on the ground next to him, I don't know if that's Eva Braun or not, tell you the truth. I can't tell. She did change.
Let me interrupt for a second, too. You said he loved animals. He was a vegan, but also he outlawed vivisection in Germany.
Hmm. Fascinating. Wow.
Most people don't know that. Vivisection, anybody who doesn't understand,
remember,
is cutting open animals with no anesthesia, just to see how the parts are working inside while they're alive, awake, and conscious. And he outlawed that in Germany.
First war on cancer, anti-smoking war, just way ahead of their time. We still don't have a real war on cancer here. We have a fraud, money-making industry called cancer treatment. We've suppressed cancer therapies for the better part of 60, 70 years. The next picture shows him again with some young boys. They must be 6, 7, 8 years old. They're just elated, and they're reaching out as he's passing by. Another extraordinary picture of him out the window of a train. And there's a large crowd gathered outside the train, and someone holds up a little girl, and he reaches out and shakes her hand. Next picture is of him, people giving him flowers. He's in a group of people, and clearly,
right. Now this is.
Go ahead.
This is an artist. Believe it. I mean, this is not a politician that's out just shaking hands. This is an artist who had an idea for a new society, and he found that he could do. Was an incredible public speaker. And when he would bring his ideas, they say when he would start the speech, you know, he would start a very conversational tone, and he would bring you up. And the emotions that he brought out of Germany was just outrageous, how much they adored him for what he was doing, communicating to them.
Yeah.
You know, I just can't stress that enough, is that, you know, the more I read about him, I'm getting ready to read Mein Kampf. It's 600 pages. It's apparently volume 1 and 2. I've ordered it. I can't wait to read that. He wrote that when he was, after World War One, when the early version of the National Socialist Party, he was arrested and put in prison. They said it was going to be for 3 or 4 or 5 years, but he only spent a year. In that year, he wrote that book. It outlines his political and social views about the world. And, you know, there's a lot of books that, you know, there's a lot of things that are said, but when the man writes the book and writes his thoughts himself, it's pretty important to read those and understand who you're talking about and not this Holocaust stuff, because, you know, they found that the American Red Cross was allowed to go into these so-called death camps and visit.
They were
all
in Auschwitz throughout the entire war, David. They had a full-time staff and office there. They knew what was going on.
Well, they, you know, at the end of the war, they put together a very lengthy report about who died from, you know, the records and stuff, and it was 283,000 people they estimated died in all, mostly from typhus or for overwork, and only 40% of those were Jewish. So, you know, the whole Holocaust is a myth, just like the story of 9/11, just like all these other Sandy Hook and all these garbage things that the media tries to tell us, you know, but. You know, we've all been programmed with all these documentaries that you know, he's evil. The truth is, he wasn't evil in the least. He adored people, and they adored him.
Yeah. What's really amusing, Elie Wiesel was in a work camp, and he wrote in his memoirs, which have been exposed to be full of a lot of crap, he complained about having to take 3 showers a day to stay healthy, and all of them. They were kept in the best of circumstances, given the fact that they were in labor camps. This is not a joke, and it's not acceptable to me. But they were not put in these camps to be liquidated. There is no evidence, as David said earlier, to sustain or support it. Fred Luchter went over there, who is an expert in gas chambers and the executions of people by gas, and took the tourist's tour of the alleged Auschwitz gas chamber. He took scrapings of the walls, and there was no evidence whatsoever anywhere of Zyklon B inside the Auschwitz gas chamber. And
he
wrote a book.
He ran into trouble with the government over there when he came out with his report, even though he had no axe to grind. He was just giving
doing science.
Yeah, just giving an even-handed report, and he got into trouble with the government.
No, the book is called The Luchter Report. You can find it online, L-E-U-C-H-T-E-R, Luchter. Read it and understand. Go ahead.
Well, they won't allow, you know, they have ground-penetrating radar. They went to Treblinka, which was it was a transit camp that they said the Jews claimed that 1 million people were buried in a mass grave, and they have a monument there. So these scientists went in with the ground-penetrating radar that can go down, you know, 100 feet and can find a fork, you know, buried down. And they, for 3 weeks, they scanned through all this land, this whole, it's not that big, a couple of football fields, and they scanned through it, didn't find that the land has ever even been disturbed. So there's no mass grave there. They went to another camp, did the same thing, found the same results. Auschwitz won't allow them in there
The Auschwitz plaque has been changed 3 times. The first plaque said, through these gates, 3 million human souls passed, never to walk out alive. Then they had to change it. Through these gates, 2 million souls passed, never to walk out alive. Then they changed it again. Through these gates, 1 million. Now it says approximately 1 million people. So, yeah, the Red Cross says 285,000 or something. So, anyway, bottom line, folks, World War II history is a lie. We don't hear about the genocidal maniac Eisenhower, who killed between 1 and 2 million human beings after the war ended, Germans. He killed them.
Open-air prisons.
Exactly.
And food
they were exposed to the elements.
Say again, Harry.
I said food was withheld from these prisoners by Eisenhower's orders. These were
absolutely
not prisoners of war. These were guys who were still in the field when the war ended, and they came in expecting to be just released into the workforce because they were not captured, and Eisenhower reclassified them. They were not POWs because POWs had protection under the Geneva Convention.
Yeah,
he reclassified them as surrendered or disarmed enemy forces, and they were in open-air prisoner camps. I was in the remains of one a few years ago. And no buildings of any kind, no barracks, no mess hall, no latrines, no nothing.
You go by and you look. I can't even imagine the relatives of the people in there. They know who was in there. And they would try to sneak food into them at night. Some of the American guards would look the other way. They still have nightmares about it, some of the Americans. They knew what was going on. They died by the hundreds of thousands.
Yeah, I think it was like 1.1 million is the generally accepted number.
Correct.
One of our members, who's now passed away, was a guard there at one of those camps. And, they had plenty of leftover food from the American mess halls. And he'd be bringing stuff to these prisoners, and he got called up and told them that if he brought them any more food, he'd get shot. And then all the excess food that wasn't eaten at these mess halls was buried rather than given to the German prisoners, because it was definitely designed to kill them.
Yeah, well, it certainly did.
And there's no movie made about this or about Dresden. You never see the History Channel playing an hour about how Dresden,
a non-combatant city.
Yeah.
Right, was firebombed, in one night, and I forget what is the number that they estimated was killed? It's
up to a half
million. So horrible.
Yeah.
It's so horrible.
It was a horrible thing to do, but it was a well-planned raid. The bombers came over first and dropped all the incendiary bombs and started the fires. And once, about an hour later, I guess, after all the rescue people were there trying to help the people and put out the fires,
so-called
the
first responders,
wave,
they came and killed them.
Anti-personnel bombs. That was all Bomber Harris. But like I said on the earlier interview today, if you lead a good life and go to heaven when you die, you're not going to meet Bomber Harris. You won't meet Ike. You won't meet Roosevelt or
FDR, Churchill, or the arch-communist Harry Hopkins, or any of the other Churchill administration.
Or Stalin.
No. Oh, my God.
You know, to sum up everything we've been talking about, if I could interject this, is that what we see happen was this was a country and a group of people that turned against the Zionist Jews and said, they kicked them out of the banking, kicked them out of the media in 1933, and Germany made a full recovery. They went from last place economically to very strong. Even while America was in the throes of a depression, Germany was thriving because they were printing their own money, and it was backed by the work of the German workers. I think if you stand back and look at World War I, World War II, it's all designed simply to destroy this incredibly talented people.
Well,
that's
even
all it is.
Churchill
said they stood up to the Zionist Jews, and I think they've used, since then, for the last 60 years, they've used the media to make sure it never happens again, that
exactly.
People don't ever stand up to us again. You know what I mean? They don't want
Churchill,
you to know how Germany thrived without them. So.
No, they don't. Churchill's book, in his memoirs, he made only one statement that really counts. He said, this was not a war about National Socialism or against National Socialism. This was a war to destroy Germany once and for all. He said it. It's in his own book. Here's a little bit more from Hitler's personal assistant.
I thought to myself, oh my goodness, here I am alone with him, and we're going to Café Leutpold? It's probably closing time over there. The driver, well, I was to pay him with a 50-mark note, and I did expect to get some change back. But Hitler said, no, let him keep it. I think I had not quite closed the door, and the taxi took off quickly. The door slammed shut, and he was gone. He was probably thinking, thank God I'm rid of them. And then we went for a walk to Marienplatz. As per usual, I started to walk a meter or so behind him, like I always do. But he said, no, come here on my side. Nobody will believe that I'm actually walking around here in Munich. It was around 11 or 11:30 at night. Whenever someone would approach us from the opposite direction, he just grabbed his hat and pulled it down a bit and kept his head tilted forward so that no one would recognize him. It was very icy. So we locked arms just to support ourselves, because it was terribly slippery. Then finally, we came to Polsientenplatz, where his apartment was, when suddenly we heard, "Halt!" There was police across the way patrolling, and there was one of his guards in the doorway from the Waffen-SS, and a couple of police officers patrolling up and down the street. And we were about to cross the street, and one calls out, "Halt! Verboten!" So Hitler stopped and waited, and I went ahead and approached them. As the man recognized me, he firmly clicked his heels together and saluted. I remember it well, even now. And then we went ahead and continued on inside the apartment. But once inside, I received some harsh words from Himmler and the others, because I hadn't reported in that I was going out alone with him in the city. But Hitler, he was never scared. He just wanted to go out and see old Munich again, alone, without being bothered, without anyone following him around. He just wanted to go alone. He would look around here and there, in this window or that one, just to see what's going on, and to see some of his favorite places again, from the old days. And he was never scared. Even in Poland, when we visited the front lines, we went to inspect some of the graves there, and he would walk around openly, with me following him as usual. Keitel and the others were just beside themselves. I mean, we were not more than 100 meters away from the front line during the war in Poland.
That's extraordinary. Carl Wilhelm Krauss, and you can look at this entire interview. Look under David D's splash art at the top of Rents. You'll see this one and another, a much longer documentary. Extremely important if you want to understand history in balance, not history as it has been so terribly skewed and corrupted and propagandized. It's really enough to make you sick. Okay, we have about 5 minutes to go, and I hope you've been looking at some of the pictures, perhaps, on the left-hand side under guests at Rents. Also take a look at some of the artwork that this young teenage artist was doing. Extraordinarily talented, no question about it. I don't know what they're bringing now, probably $50,000, $100,000 per, if you can find any. They're out there. But It's not only an unknown Hitler, it's an unknown piece of history. We have only one side, and it is it's not reality. And I hope that this program has done something to get you at least a little bit interested in perhaps what really happened back then. It is important to know. Harry, anything you want to? We have about 4 minutes left. You want to put
well,
in here?
I was just going to say. I appreciate you and Jeff carrying this show, because I'm really not an expert on Hitler the man, but rather on the U-boats and Hitler's escape to Argentina. But if any of your listeners would like, just go to sharkhunters.com for more information on what we do on this history. And as I say, if they send me an email at sharkhunters@earthlink.net and say they would like a copy of our magazine, I'll send out an email copy to them. But I got to tell you, I've learned a lot. You and David are way, way more ahead on Hitler the man than I was. I just am learning a lot from you guys.
Well, you've had a long day, my friend, and I wanted to just do something a little different tonight, so. That's what we're doing. This other side, the human side of a human being, it's a story that needs to be told, and perhaps one day someone will put out a book full of photographs and the truths. The interview with his personal assistant is extraordinary to hear and listen and understand. You hear some of the stories about Winston Churchill, you want to vomit. The guy was just putrid.
He was a weird guy, that's for sure.
Yeah, a pervert owned by Bernard Baruch, probably the wealthiest Jew of the last century, bought Churchill's ass twice when he lost it. And guess who was on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange on Black Friday in 1929, Bernard Baruch and Winston Churchill. You think they might have known? Could that have possibly been a contrived event? You bet your bottom dollar it was. David, anything else to add?
Well, let's see. I would say be sure and take a look at the books. I designed the covers for the last 9 books that he added to his library. They're incredible pieces of history. And go to my website if you need some book cover done. It's
Let me step in here. If anyone out there is working on a documentary or a book and they need a cover or some kind of a box cover for their DVD, contact David Dees. He is close your ears, David. David Dees is a genius, and his art is extraordinary. And if you want to make a statement with your project, contact David and bring him on board to do your project. He will do what you want, not what he wants, like a lot of artists do, and you will get 100% satisfaction and a cover that will remain something you will always be extremely proud of. And the old saying, you can't tell a book by its cover, well, in the case of David Dees, you can get a very good idea of the quality of the book. And Harry Cooper's books, now 9 of them already have David Dees covers. There'll be more. And I hope all of you will take advantage of that and read.
We're coming
history.
Out with about another 12 to 15 books this year, and David's going to do the covers on all of them. I wouldn't have anybody else do my covers. This guy is just inventive, and he's really, I better not talk too good about it. He'll jack the price on me.
You guys, you're making me blush. But go to dds.com. It's two D's, two E's, and an S.com, and you can see my work there. I appreciate that's nice.
You're very welcome. You've always, of course, been at the top of Rents.com, and it just wouldn't be the same without you. And underneath David's art, you'll find links to his galleries. You can go back and look at some of the amazing things. He has a way of looking at life and reality and interpreting it that has reinvented political commentary. They used to call them political cartoons, but it's political commentary is what it is. And it's taken it to a whole new and different level. David, thanks so much for being here tonight. It's always a pleasure talking to you, my friend. You take care.
Thank you.
All right.
Bye, Harry.
Good night, guys.
Yeah, Harry, not off the hook yet. We got a minute. Now,
okay.
I just want to ask people again to visit the Shark Hunters website, sharkhunters.com, and check into the tours that are coming up this year. If you want to see history and spend time with Harry Cooper and some just amazing people, look into these tours. They're not huge, but they go to places that nobody else gets to go and to see things that nobody else gets to see.
We haven't even posted the tour yet on the website, but people have, you get our daily hot mails, you get them. We've already got people signing up for the tour, and we can only take 40. So if anybody wants information on the tour, patrols we call them, they can ask me on the emails, and we'll send out information. And you're right, Ein Gang Verboten means shark hunters are welcome here.
Indeed. Harry, thanks for staying up late. We appreciate you. I'll talk soon.
Okay, have a good evening, guys, and I'm going to go look at the inside of my eyelid now.
Good. You deserve it. All right. Take care. Talk to you.
Good night, guys.
Good night. Harry Cooper and sharkhunters.com. All right. That's our first 2 hours for you tonight. A little different, a little unusual, and just hoping you'll be able to get a look at the other side of the coin, at least for a few minutes. And we'll be right back with Hour 3.